studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson. My usual co-host Chris Cherniak is out this week and next, so Katie Wang is here to join me. What most people probably know in this community is that Katie is the executive director of the Park City Film Series, but what they may not know is that she has a secret environmental background with a master's in environmental policy. Katie, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here. As you've likely heard, Park City has set some ambitious climate goals, including net zero carbon for municipal operations by 2022 and net zero carbon for the entire community by 2032.
So here to tell us how we'll get there is Celia Peterson, Park City's Environmental Sustainability Project Manager. She recently joined the Park City Sustainability Team exactly 6 months ago and is focusing on the city's carbon footprint. She'll give us an idea of the steps that the city and the community will need to take to reach those ambitious goals and discuss the role of carbon sinks such as open space. Along those lines, Sarah Jo Dickens with the Summit Land Conservancy is here to join us to talk about an upcoming project.
During the second half of the show, we'll turn our attention to environmental education, where I have my degree, my secret expertise.
That's right.
And its critical importance to students. Environmental education not only teaches kids about the natural world, of course, but also increases their test scores, improves their physical health, and improves their critical thinking skills.
Here to tell us more about that will be Kathy McLaughlin. She's internationally recognized for her experience in environmental education, and she's the Senior Vice President of Education for the American Forest Foundation and Executive Director for Project Learning Tree.
Remember, we don't take calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth, our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay tuned and stay with us.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
Hi, this is Brenda with Republic Services, your local source for recycling and garbage collection and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. As you recycle, please remember, glass cannot go in your residential curbside recycling bin. Thank you for helping to keep Summit County clean and green. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson here with co-host Katie Wang. And joining us for the first half of the show is Celia Peterson, the Environmental Sustainability Project Manager at Park City Municipal. So Celia, thanks so much for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's start with this. In your role as Environmental Sustainability Project Manager, I think you're one member of a two-person team at the city working on environmental sustainability. So tell us a little bit about your role.
Yep. So, as you said, I'm the Environmental Sustainability Project Manager, and I guess my role is to really manage the city's carbon footprint and make sure that we're making progress towards our goals, which happen to be North America's most ambitious climate goals. So, right. So, one of the
that's a big job.
Yeah. So we've got a lot going on. That's for sure. One of the first things that I did when I came on board was to calculate the municipal footprint just as sort of a baseline to see how far we've got to come in order to hit our goals. So, and I guess the outcome of that was really opening my eyes to look at our municipal buildings and then also water distribution are really the heaviest components of our carbon footprint. So we're working with the public utilities team to look at how we can make water distribution as efficient as possible and optimizing operations there. Then also working with our buildings and setting a net zero energy standard for our buildings moving forward in Park City to tackle those big components of the carbon footprint. Also working, Luke Carton is my colleague in the environmental sustainability team. And with him, we're looking at the fleet and looking at how to electrify the fleet in order to make sure that when we get are working with Rocky Mountain Power and bringing online new renewables to have clean vehicles to move people around in Park City.
So just review what those goals are for us, for the municipality and also for the community as a whole. Mm-hmm. And if you've got this, tell us kind of where we stand now.
Yep. So the goals are that the city will be net zero carbon and running on 100% renewable electricity by 2022 for municipal operations, and by 2032 for the whole community. So like I mentioned, we've got the municipal footprint down. We did it for 2016, finished that up in January. And if I remember correctly, we're at about 16,000 megatons of CO2.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And
sounds big.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yep. And then we're now working on the community footprint, and that's a pretty big project to tackle, because scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, I don't want to get too technical here, but scope 1 and scope 2 emissions are kind of under our control. That is direct emissions, so fossil fuels that are burnt or combusted within city boundaries. Then scope 2 is purchased electricity, so the emissions that are coming from electricity generation, which are quite high in Utah, being that our state rock is coal, and we're pretty heavy on coal, but we're working with Rocky Mountain Power to shift new renewables online so that we can be certain that our electricity is being generated from new renewables.
So at one point when Tyler Paulson, who I think was mm-hmm. two people before Luke, was here, we had this conversation with Save Our Snow, and the Park City Community Foundation did this whole study initially. And really where we got to with trying to get to net zero in Tyler's estimation was that we needed to produce our own energy, which is what, of course, the city of Boulder has gone ahead and done, so that you can be sure you're getting 100% renewables and you know exactly where it's coming from. Is that something that at the time the city was not going to consider it? My understanding was that conversation perhaps has been being revisited. Is that true? Is that, where's the city kind of thinking along those lines?
Right. Yeah. So in Boulder, from what I've heard, it hasn't been as easy and straightforward. But we have signed a cooperative agreement with Rocky Mountain Power, and that means that we'll be working with them collaboratively to bring renewables online. So
does that mean we invest in solar farms, wind farms with them, and then we're guaranteed to get our power from those particular sources?
Right. So we're working with them to bring new wind power and solar online. So, and this isn't that we'll be purchasing renewables that are already online, but bringing new renewables online. So that's what our cooperative agreement is all about.
Got it. So moving on to kind of the community carbon footprint beyond the municipal, that obviously is much more complex to think about, because yep. these are things that are sort of less under, I guess, the city's control, right?
Mm-hmm.
What might that look like for, you know, for residents, for businesses, and even like what's the role of, you know, some of the massive commercial developments or hotels that we have? How does that all fit in?
Yeah, so it is complex, and it's not going to be easy to meet the 2032 goals, but we are trying to bring as much public transportation online so that people can move around, because that will be a huge component of the community goal. But then also looking at creative ways to incentivize more efficient housing. That's another big piece that we don't know what the exact figure is, but it's pretty easy to tell with so many big houses around and not the most efficient houses, that there's a lot of progress to be made there. So
I'd be remiss in my role as Chris's surrogate. I'm missing not asking you about heat tape and heated driveways. I know this is Chris's.
He'll be so proud, Katie.
Yes, yep. I've got to hold that torch for him. Mm-hmm. Is there any way to regulate that? I mean, I live out in the county, so I guess I don't count necessarily in this equation. But, you know, I have to use heat tape like everybody else. And if it's not on, you know, I one year had to remove 2,000 pounds of ice from my roof. So that wasn't a lot of fun. But so how do you get people to use it more efficiently? Are there more efficient versions of heat tape? Do we go back to shoveling our roofs? I mean, what's the solution for something like that?
Yeah, there's been a lot of discussion about it, but no decisions made. So Luke and I are looking at different opportunities. We are limited in some ways just by the state and what we can do in terms of energy efficiency and writing. We don't have the ability to write energy efficiency into our own municipal code, but we're looking at creative ways that we can work with the land use code. And then also incentivizing better behaviors when it comes to energy efficiency, but no firm decisions made at this point.
We won't have you back up on your roof just yet.
Darn. I'm hoping there was some silver bullet.
So give us an idea of what our current breakdown of our carbon footprint looks like. Where is the bulk of this coming from? Is it the driving? Is it, you know, our homes? Is it pumping the water where it needs to be? Give us an idea of what that pie chart looks like.
Yep. So, like I said, we've tackled the municipal footprint. So this is all municipal operations, not community-wide yet. That should be ready in August. So happy to come back on and talk about the community-wide footprint a bit later. But in terms of the municipal footprint, the bulk of it is, well, about, I think it's 32% is coming from municipal buildings and facilities. And then another 36%, I believe, is coming from water distribution. So Park City, right. So Park City has a very complex water distribution system, and it's expensive and uses a lot of energy to pump water around. So that's why we're focusing our work with the Public Utilities Department to work on that. Then also another interesting thing that I found, we looked at the transit fleet, so that's the buses that are moving around, but then also looked into the employee commute. That's typically is calculated, the scope 3 emissions is business travel and employee commutes, and the people that work at Park City Municipal have pretty long commutes, so we're working with our transportation team and trying to think of ways that people can either carpool or ride instead of driving into work.
So speaking of that, does that fit in? I mean, it's a little bit peripheral, but are you then considering workforce housing so people don't have to drive, or more live workspaces so that, I mean, I grew up in New York City, so you would never drive your car anywhere, right? Mm. I mean, I would commute an hour and a half to school, but I took the subway along with hundreds of thousands of other people. But if you live closer to where you work, clearly you can then, you're more able to take the bus, to take the bus or walk.
Absolutely. So Park City has 3 critical priorities, and one's energy and climate, and that's what I'm specializing in, along with Luke, of course. But then the other two are pretty strongly linked to sustainability. So the second one is transportation, and looking at ways that we can kind of make transportation around the city less carbon intensive and more efficient. And then the third is affordable housing. So we know that Park City has pretty high rents and it's expensive to live here. So the city is building more affordable housing so that municipal employees and people that actually work in Park City can live in Park City as well. Bless you.
Excuse me. Sorry, Nels.
I was trying to.
Well, it's interesting to see it all linking in. I mean, one would hope that it's not just this in isolation, we're going to get to net zero and let's not think about the other components of that. I mean, I assume there's also, the educational piece of that, which is, of course, the second half of the show. Environmental education is something that, you know, I'm particularly passionate about. But in terms of educating the community and people that come here, is that part of the conversation yet? Of, hey, we've got these, I mean, I happen to work in the Park City Library building, and there's really not a lot of signage about how efficient that building is.
Right.
You know, I don't even know how efficient it is. I know that there was a lot of money put into it because I was part of that planning process. but to, like at Swanner, you know, to have signage that says, you know, low flow toilets or we've got solar panels. I mean, is that going to be part of the plan at
some
point?
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. So right now, Luke and I have our energy roadshow. So now that we've got the carbon footprint of municipal operations taken care of for 2016, what we're doing is really focusing inwards right now and trying to engage different municipal teams around our goals and having discussions with them of, okay, this is where things look like or what things look like in terms of energy consumption in your particular area of work, and then coming up with creative ideas as a group and really an engaging process to get everybody on board in order to meet our goals, because that's one thing with having such ambitious goals. We need everybody's to be aligned and heading towards the same goals and make sure everybody understands everything, but then also trying to instill a sense of ownership with people so that they know what they can do in order to save energy and help us meet those goals.
I love the title of the Energy Road Show. I get a very good visual. You're like driving a wagon around town with a circus.
How much is a solar panel worth?
That's right.
It's been fun.
So one other piece, of course, of this carbon equation, I guess, is, you know, obviously we're focusing on decreasing how much we use or how much CO2 we create, how much energy we use. But the other piece, of course, is the carbon sinks, the open space, what CO2 is being taken out of the air. So give us a feel for how you guys are working that into the equation and where our open space stands in that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So not only are we measuring how much carbon emissions we're pumping out through municipal activities, we're also starting to look at how much carbon is getting soaked up in our open spaces. And so we're just kicking off a project to start quantifying that right now. So no numbers or results to share with you at this point. But in the meantime, we also don't want to be measuring things all the time. We really want to get out and be active and start implementing things, because having such audacious goals, we can't sit around and do nothing. So on this Sunday, the 4th, we will be planting trees. And this summer, we'll be having a couple of tree planting events. And that is an effort to increase the amount of carbon that we are soaking up in our open spaces, and looking at different land management techniques that we can implement in order to increase the amount of carbon that we're soaking up and keeping away from the atmosphere.
So how much is a tree, just to kind of put a number on it? So you plant one tree.
Mm-hmm.
What's the CO2 equivalent, and what does that mean to the layperson? Is that X number of hours in my car, gallons of fuel? What is that?
Yeah, we're just kicking the project off, so we don't know exactly at this point. But when when all the numbers are together, then we'll communicate it in terms that hopefully people can understand and are meaningful.
So there isn't a sense, just generally speaking, of what a tree, how much value one tree has, like that pine tree I'm looking at, the ponderosa pine?
Pine on the hill.
There is, I just don't know.
Okay.
So what is the plan for this? How many trees? Where are you looking at planting them? Like what parts of town, and how did you select those?
Mm-hmm. So Sarah Jo has been quiet over here, and she can feel free
yes,
to
maybe
pipe
now,
up.
Maybe now's when we bring Sarah Jo in. We have Sarah Jo Dickinson with the Summit Land Conservancy also with us here this morning.
Yeah, so I can just give like a brief background of the project. So we originally worked with USU's Forestry Extension, just asking questions about what tree species sequester the most carbon. And the rule of thumb is the fastest growing and the densest trees, so hardwoods typically are the ones that sequester the most carbon. But we also need to be sure that we're planting native species. We don't want to bring in anything that's not natural in our environment, because we'll be planting several hundred trees throughout the summer, and we want to select native species that grow here naturally, but then also ones that require the least maintenance and the least amount of watering, because we want to eventually go big with this and just plant a lot of trees but not have to spend staff time to take care of all of them. So this isn't like landscaping or ornamental activity, but more of a carbon sequestration activity.
Got it.
But then we've partnered with Summit Lands on this, and they've helped us with the tree selection as well, and then also generating the volunteer effort that will be needed to plant these trees. So
where will you be? I know you were talking about it a little bit with Leslie, but for those folks who might not have caught that part of her show.
Yep. So on Sunday the 4th, we'll start at 9 o'clock, and we're going to be planting in Round Valley. And yeah, so hopefully.
Why Round Valley?
Yeah,
so don't seem a lot of trees out there right now. Is that why?
Mm-hmm. Yep, we want to see what takes, because naturally that probably there were trees there at one point, but through overgrazing throughout the years and end up with a lot of sagebrush, I guess.
But there are wetland areas in Round Valley that kind of lend themselves to being able to introduce some of the native species. So we're looking at using willows as well as cottonwoods, and then adding some of these pines that people would normally not consider species that you'd want to plant out there. And those are going to be located sort of on the edges of wetland more often than not. And so they'll still have access to deeper water longer because of that wetland interface, but they won't be so far into it that they kind of drowned out, don't get the oxygen that they need to have. And we're also using other species other than trees. So we are using dogwood, and that's more natural and easier to introduce into the system. It may not create a huge tree trunk, but over time it certainly will sequester quite a bit of carbon. And the roots, I mean, we have to think about not just the trunks that we see above ground, but having deeper roots allows for more water to get into the soil, and wet soil is more active. And that activity increases the amount of carbon the soil itself can also sequester.
So it seems like you have a pretty short window to plant, right? I mean, you're already planting in July. I would imagine it would kind of shock the trees. So are you going to be planting in the next couple of weeks?
Typically,
you mentioned throughout the summer. But
yeah, they say typically we need to get it done by like June 15th, I think, is the latest. And so we'll do this first bit. And then I don't know, Celia can say for sure, but I know there was talk of doing it later in the fall again when the temperatures are going to be a little bit more conducive to planting.
So if people are interested in helping with planting or helping with the project, what do they need to do?
So I think the best thing would be to, on both of our web pages, you can go to parkcity.org, and on the main page you can see a link to sign up there. And then also at wesavelands.org, there's the same link, and then sign up and it'll have more information. But the basic information is that we'll be meeting on Sunday the 4th, next Sunday at 9 a.m., and planting trees. So.
And don't bring your dogs or small children, I read.
Yes, yes.
Prepare
please.
To work unless they have work, unless they've worked in the button factory for a couple of years.
And they are small trees, but it is still digging in clay, so it's going to be a little bit of work.
So are you looking for people to bring their, you know, their spades, their shovels, their work gloves, and all that kind of equipment as well?
Please, yes.
The reusable
you have
water
them.
Bottles.
Always.
Yes, reusable water bottles.
Perfect. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left. Celia, anything else that you want to add on the city's front as far as the carbon footprint and net zero efforts?
Just that we're moving full steam ahead, Luke and I, with it. Trying to get out and like do implement actions as we're measuring things. So I use the term a lot that we're building the airplane as we're already in the air. So
yep. We talked a minute before we came on air about how these are really ambitious goals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you jumped in about 6 months ago, as did Luke. And, you know, do you think we're going to meet these in 5 years and 15 years?
Definitely.
All right. I like to hear that.
Yep.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. That was Celia Peterson, the Environmental Sustainability Project Manager for Park City Municipal, and Sarah Jo Dickinson with the Summit Land Conservancy. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
G'day. This is Ian from Campos Coffee, a proud KPCW sponsor. Our first winter in Park City was awesome. Thanks for accepting us into our community. We're open for breakfast and lunch every day during the mud season. We're just above the ice rink at Park City Mountain. CamposCoffee.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch Counties.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Katie Wang.
And joining us for the second half of the show will be Kathy McLaughlin. She is internationally recognized for her expertise in environmental education. She's also the executive director of the national organization called Project Learning Tree. Kathy, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's start with this. You are the executive director of Project Learning Tree, as I just mentioned. So tell us a little bit about your organization and what it is you do.
Sure, thank you. So Project Learning Tree is an environmental education program that's been around since the 1970s with a goal of teaching young people pre-K through college how to think, not what to think, about complex environmental issues. It follows the goals of environmental education, and we do basically three three big things. We provide supplementary curriculum materials to educators. We have a national and international network of sponsoring organizations who are the folks who deliver the curriculum materials to teachers in their state or country. And then we have our distribution system is through professional development. The early developers of Project Learning Tree decided early on that the best way to get materials used by teachers is to provide them with professional development as opposed to just putting them out there. And so for over, 40 years, we've been providing Project Learning Tree through in-person workshops and in the last few years as well through online professional development experiences where the educators have an opportunity to try out the lessons, think about how they will work in their own classroom, process the opportunities that they can have in order to use the materials with the goal of really, the outcome we're looking for is that when they go back to their classroom, they're ready to use these materials to help supplement what they're already supposed to be teaching their own students.
Well, great. So while you're in D.C., there's also a chapter here in Utah, I believe, right?
That's correct.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Project Learning Tree, we're in the national office here in Washington, D.C., but the work happens at the state and local level. So each state has an organization that sponsors the program and uses the materials in ways that help them do their job. So in Utah, our state sponsors are the Utah Society for Environmental Education, and they are the providers then of the PLT training and curriculum materials and other opportunities for educators.
So we throw around the term environmental education a lot, but let's actually take a minute and define what that is. You know, how would you describe what environmental education is?
Sure. Environmental education is really a process. It really seeks to increase a learner's both awareness and knowledge about the environment and then related issues. We really think that environmental education enhances critical thinking skills. You know, as we look at complex environmental issues, we need to be critical thinkers about and good problem solvers. So environmental education helps develop problem-solving and decision-making skills. It helps the individuals understand that there are generally many sides to complex environmental issues, and that we really encourage them, the learners, to make informed and responsible decisions. So it goes back to what I said, the sort of big goal for Project Learning Tree is teaching young people how to think, not what to think. So, and really, I think it's important to point out that environmental education is not an advocacy program. There's a distinction between environmental education and environmental advocacy or environmental information. And we are, the environmental education field is very clear that we do not advocate a particular point of view on any one topic.
Kathy, it's good to talk to you after, I think, almost a decade of leaving the environmental field, or at least the environmental education field, but certainly something, a topic that's still close to my heart. And I'm curious, in the intervening decades since I've been involved with it, how have you seen things change? I mean, I think there's still, it's interesting talking before the show about how people are still confused about environmental education. And I know Richard Louv's books come out in the intervening years, No Child Left Inside. And I'm just kind of curious the impact that that's had on the conversation nationally from your perspective of kind of the acceptance of environmental education and how important it is really to our children for these critical thinking skills and all these things we were talking about.
Great. And Katie, it was a pleasure to see your name again. So I look forward to running into you one of these days. So, sure, a lot has changed, and I, of course, have been around for a long time, so I've seen a lot of changes. I think some of the biggest changes are that we are really more mainstreaming environmental education in the K-12 school system, where we are working very diligently at assuring that our materials that we're providing to educators are aligned with and help to support the standards that teachers are required to teach. So, for example, in Utah, I believe, and I'm not sure the exact timing on this, but the state has recently adopted new curriculum standards. So our program in Utah is working on taking a look at the PLT materials that we have and aligning them to those standards. So if you're a classroom teacher, say in the third grade, you can see, here's how these environmental education lessons support what it is I'm already supposed to be teaching, whether it's in math, science, language arts, history, social studies, and any of the topics up through high school. So this connecting to standards is critical. Teachers don't have time just to add things to a very busy schedule, so we have to make certain that our materials are relevant to meeting teachers' needs. And so we're really connecting with what has to happen in the formal classroom. I think the other thing, talking about getting kids outside to learn, we do know that students spend most of their time, in classrooms, so that's a great opportunity to help develop in young people an awareness of and understanding of and respect for and I hope love for the natural world as well as understanding the built environment. So we need to do that in classrooms. But I also believe this notion of connecting kids and families to the outdoors is critically important. Getting kids outside, not just on the soccer field, but in a local park or moving around in the backyard. Digging holes in the backyard is as important. And so Richard Louv's book really helped inspire folks to really think about how they're engaging their kids and, their neighborhood and that in understanding the world they live in, their place within it, and their responsibility for it.
Does PLT, being a forestry-based organization, work at all with the mm-hmm. forest kindergartens? That's something that's come up a lot in this community, mm-hmm. And people are certainly captivated by that idea of that, these kids just basically spend their entire kindergarten year outside. And I'm just curious if that's something.
Isn't it great?
It's amazing. I want to go back to kindergarten. I'm ready.
I know. So again, our programs are run at the state level. So I honestly don't know exactly what the Utah folks may or may not be doing. I'm hoping that they're connecting with those programs, and we certainly encourage that. My history, going back to working in the early days in Wisconsin, I worked at a school forest for a summer where we had sixth grade students come in for week-long sessions at the Marshfield School Forest. So it's something that's been going on a long time, but I think there's some new excitement and new awareness of it. And there's a whole movement getting all the preschools, getting early learners really deeply engaged in the world around them. Project Learning Tree created some new pre-K materials a couple of years ago, and they've been very popular. I know there's a workshop coming up in Utah next week on
fantastic.
The early environmental experiences for early childhood educators. So those are going on, around the country. But I love this idea of the forest education centers. I had an opportunity to visit a school in Colorado that is in the woods, and the kids spend all day outside. I mean, it was amazing. I had the greatest visit with the educators and the students, and just seeing how they're connecting the world around them to what it is they need to learn, to accomplish the state standards and that. You can do it. It's doable.
Well, that's what's so amazing, I think, is that connection to, quote unquote, the real world, that it's not just mm-hmm. playing outside in the environment, but it's math, it's
right.
art, it's learning kind of your body's relationship to the physical environment. Kind of jumping ahead to older kids, I know PLT has some curriculum around kind of more complex environmental issues, as you mentioned. So I'd be curious to hear more about how you deal with topics like climate change or public lands issues, which are particularly in this state and I think increasingly around the country, controversial.
Absolutely. Right. And so, I appreciate that you recognize the importance of appropriate grade levels for this. we're certainly not going to talk to a five-year-old about, the concerns over climate change on the impact on their world. But Certainly at the secondary level, middle school, secondary level for sure, we do that. And again, we use the same philosophy that we help them see what is the, you know, research that's out there, what's currently known, and, you know, what can one do about it. So, for example, we have a series of lessons at the high school level on climate change, and, you know, help the students know that it is a big challenge that faces the planet, but not everybody agrees with that. I would say most people do. It does challenge high school science teachers on how to address that topic to, you know, accurately convey the data, reveal assumptions, engage the students, I think, in critical thinking skills, you know, perhaps looking at a variety of opinions that might be posted in online forums or in their local newspaper about climate change issues, and really helping them understand, you know, why are there various opinions? You know, what's behind the opinions about climate change as an example? What are folks thinking about that and why? You know, climate change is so complex, and I think for high school students even, you know, how can they figure out how they can make a difference on that? And so, you know, I think with good environmental education sort of avoids that sort of, quote, simple solution, because these issues are complex. But we want to engage the students in thinking that there is hope, and there are things that they can do as well as, you know, make a difference in their community. And so we work at lessons for them where they can see, well, what can they do? So it's things like taking a look at their own carbon footprint and examining choices and decisions they make in their daily lives and how those perhaps could change, and then reflecting that out to what can happen in the greater community and state and nation and the world to be able to make those applications about changes that can be made to have an impact on climate change.
Well, it's so interesting to hear you say that, and encouraging, because I obviously work in environmental education at the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center, and we definitely get a sense that some of the kids just feel overwhelmed and really negative, right, about the things that are happening to our world and our environment. You know, they're barraged with the same news that we are in a lot of cases, mm-hmm, with some pretty negative headlines. And you know, that's not how you want the fourth grader to feel. You want them to feel hopeful and excited about what their own contribution can be and what the future might look like.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I think, you know, that it's more complex than, no offense to recycling, but it's more complex than just recycling your can. I think people sometimes dumb things down for kids and say, oh, well, they can recycle and they can, you know, walk to school. That's important. But they really can engage at a deeper level, I think, and just, you know, their locus of control is much stronger than that, certainly as they get older. And we were just, before you came on, Kathy, talking with the state and the city and sustainability department about our ambitious net zero goals. So mm-hmm, you know, maybe it could be something interesting to revisit with you, how we could bring some Project Learning Tree curriculum into our schools to help the kids realize how they could be helpful in achieving the community-wide goals, certainly.
Right. We have a program called Green Schools, and it's essentially a series of investigations or audits that students do at their school and in their community and at their home, and helping them see what they sort of do, a basic where is our school, for example, on, we can use recycling as an example, you know, is our school recycling, for what, to what, where does it go, really understanding what's behind that notion of let's just recycle. And then upon developing an assessment, you know, baseline of data of where we are, they can make a determination. Is there an opportunity to make improvements? You know, perhaps on the, they're already doing everything they can in that area, and they might want to then look at energy use or their waste management, water use, environmental quality, what are their HVAC systems like in their school? So that we engage the students, it's youth voice and youth empowerment for them to be able to make, you know, informed choices, not just let's just recycle, but why are we recycling? Where are we today? What needs to be done? What will make a difference?
So I want to talk a little bit also about the benefits of environmental education to the kids that are participating in it? Because I think, you know, we hear environmental education, we think that's fun, that's really cool, that's good that they're learning about those important issues. But there are also some benefits to kids beyond that. They're, you know, their health and their ability levels. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. Well, one of the things, again, that the whole business of, you know, No Child Left Inside, we know that experiences in the outdoors in early age lead to, you know, decisions that one makes as one goes through life that are sort of more understanding about the environment. I would venture to say that the two of you had experiences as young folks that have led you to your career. Certainly that's the case with me.
Absolutely.
But I think, yeah, I think that we also know there's some reduced, there's some health benefits to being outside and working in the environment, from reductions in absenteeism at schools with kids who are engaged, some of the at-risk things, the whole engaging students who have different learning abilities find that environmental education activities might be just the ticket for them to find a place for them in their school. So health benefits, obesity rates, all of those kinds of things are sort of documented in various journals and such. But I also think it's really just an opportunity for kids to find their own place. You know, I think there's wonderful examples of young people who get engaged. We have a story of someone who down in Houston at a high school was feeling they were an at-risk student. It was an area of concern, and the Green Schools program came in, and this young woman found her place, and she's now gone on to college, and she's working, and I think it's a biology degree, and she just got engaged in a way that she never connected with school prior to that. You know, she found her voice. So I think there are benefits for students other than the, you know, if we think about a traditional classroom where it's sort of textbook focused and exam focused and that, and it's, you know, you're focused on reading and writing and, you know, following lesson plans and that, but you're not getting outside to learn. I mean, I remember my first botany class at the University of Wisconsin. I was hoping to get outside and look at plants, and all we did was look in a microscope at cells, and I found that really disconcerting. So, you know, I think one of the things that environmental education does is encourages field investigations, getting students outside, you know, to explore and experience is critical.
And, you know, there's also mental health benefits. That's certainly something we've been focused on here in Park City the past month, Mental Health Awareness Month for us. You know, one of our panels that we had after a film that I showed said, you know, the best thing you can do, you know, honestly, to improve your mental health is go outside, spend time in everyday nature. And just, you know, the natural environment has such a healing power that I think people forget sometimes. You're right. You know, it's not just the soccer field. It's not just the act of being outside, but it's really being present and kind of doing nothing, right? That putting away your phone or your screen and just, you know, reconnecting with nature is such a powerful medicine, I think.
Absolutely. And for the teachers, too, I mean, I think, you know, they have a lot of challenges. And for classroom teachers who are sort of new to environmental education, when you help them see the opportunities that exist outside the classroom door and how that can get their students enthusiastic about learning, it's very powerful. You know, teachers see changes in their students. I think they see changes in themselves. They become re-engaged in the wonderful profession of teaching young people. So it's also an opportunity, I think, as we provide professional development and encourage K-12 educators to take advantage of the world outside their door is making a difference in their lives as well.
And I want to say one of the things I do love about PLT, about Project Learning Tree, is that you can't just download the curriculum off the website. You have to go to a workshop. You have to engage with someone else. And there's such a power to that in terms of, I think that teachers feel, particularly if you're a young teacher or if you're working with younger children, there's a little bit of fear of taking them outside that, oh my goodness, they're all going to run around and be crazy people, which they are probably. But being able to work through that with someone else who's done this a couple times, and then you realize, oh, you can use that energy to get them engaged, because they're going to be engaged inherently in these activities because they love being outside, one.
Right.
But then you have these really interesting activities for them to do that Project Learning Trees put together. So that's kind of all set up. But I really like that it's interactive. It's not just, oh, here it is, and, you know, good luck with that.
Right. And they become a member of a community, and we know how important community is to providing change. You know, for teachers to change their teaching behaviors, they need support from peers. They need support from their supervisors. So, you know, we work pretty hard at making certain that school administrators understand the value and importance of environmental education and support their educators in engaging in professional development to allow them to incorporate that into their classroom. So that's also a critical component. You know, you don't want to be the lone teacher out there who doesn't have any support. So we work hard at that community effort as well and do re-engage with educators through a variety of communication tools and encourage our state programs to reinvigorate their teachers who've come to their experiences and encourage them to go visit places like Swainer Environmental Education. You know, that there's opportunities for teachers in their community to find special places for their students as well. It's more than just outside the classroom door. They're wonderful places, so...
So if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Kathy McLaughlin. She's the executive director of Project Learning Tree and has a deep history in environmental education. So Kathy, I have to ask, what was it that first drew you or brought you to the field of environmental education?
So I grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, and a good family friend was a birder. He was in the local Audubon chapter, and he got me engaged in bird watching at an early age, and I became thrilled with that idea. And so my goal was to work for the National Audubon Society. I set that up as a goal as a young girl, and it actually worked out. So
my plans as a marine biologist, on the other hand, did not pan out, but you know.
Well, what I thought is I would work out west someplace, and actually, what happened is I ended up working in Manhattan, and so where Audubon's headquarters were. So it wasn't exactly that wonderful outdoor mountain experience that I thought I would have, you know, and be in the environment all day. But I quickly realized that, you know, we needed people who were helping folks understand the importance of special places, like five national parks in Utah, for example. That was as important, and so I could do that work from an office in Midtown Manhattan just as easily as I could if I were out in the field someplace. So I have dedicated my career to helping others see the importance of this, and I have felt, you know, it's been a good place for me.
Well, I think it's good to be. I mean, I grew up in New York City, so I feel like having an appreciation too of what the urban environment is and how there is. I mean, Central Park is an amazing resource, Prospect Park, these little pocket parks that, you know, it's beautiful to come and exciting to go to the big national parks out west, but connecting people to everyday nature. And really, I think one of my experiences was they had what they called the purple people eaters, these guys who would scoop up all the horse poop around Central Park. And they created these community gardens in Lower Manhattan, which in the 70s were pretty much devastated. And I remember eating asparagus for the first time, you know, just a shoot growing straight out of the ground in Lower Manhattan. I had never seen it grown before. And it was this pivotal experience of seeing your food coming out of the ground and, you know, surrounded in this urban environment. Was just so amazing that nature could exist somewhere like that it just kind of opens your mind to different possibilities. So probably not the least obvious place, you know, probably the least obvious place for Audubon Society to be based, but you know, I think in many ways it's strategic.
it works. You know, you bring up gardens, and that's a big movement as well in the environmental field right now, where schools, that may be their first foray into the, quote, environment by having a sort of planned garden, whether it's for vegetables to consume in the school cafeteria or a butterfly garden to attract butterfly species. That's a huge movement, and it's a big part of the Green Schools program as well. And so for a lot of educators, that's a good entry point into getting their students involved in the environment. So I didn't want to leave. I'm glad you brought up the asparagus.
Well, it's something that's growing here too. Growing, the operative word there. A movement that is taking a hold here in our community of growing your own food, taking roots. Yes, the roots are spreading. But healthy eating, right? That's all part of it, right? Healthy mind, healthy body.
Absolutely.
That trying to improve our school lunch program through growing food, on school grounds, so that they have access to fresh produce. Being in the Mountain West, it's a little bit harder in the winter time, certainly, to do that. But we have indoor gardens, vertical gardens. So, again, kind of imagining what's possible. You just got to put your mind to it, and you have all sorts of problems you can solve. So,
absolutely.
Well, Kathy, before we let you go, I want to note a few things. First thing, I just want to ask, if people that are listening, if this struck a chord, they want to get involved, they want to learn more about Project Learning Tree and your work there, what are the best steps for them to take?
So I think a first step would go to plt.org. That's Project Learning Tree, but it's just the letters plt.org. And you can take a look at our website, and there you can find what's going on in your state. So Utah, for example, has a page that connects to the Utah program. You click on the training and get PLT in my state, and the map pops up, and you click on Utah, and you'll find the context for Utah. So that would be a good place. They're always looking for folks who want to help with the professional development experiences, offer sites for schools to visit, provide opportunities to support classroom teachers in the work they're doing, and then to find out what, if your parents, we also have a family activities pages on our website that you can download. This is one exception, Katie, where we provide these lessons for families that are modified Project Learning Tree activities written for a parent or an uncle or a grandparent to take a young person on a hike or a walk and do some lessons that can sort of deepen their understanding of the world around them. So those pages are available on our website. Those might be good places to start. And then support green schools in your community as well.
Fantastic. And then, of course, the other thing that I have to mention is that, Kathy, you will be coming here to Park City next week. A shameless self-promotion for the Swanner Preserve and Eco Center. You'll be speaking at our annual donor breakfast on Friday, June 9th at 8:30 a.m. And if people are interested in attending that to hear Kathy speak and learn more about environmental education, you can email peregrinebosler@usu.edu or just give us a call at Swanner, and we can work with you on that.
Yeah, and I'd say don't miss this opportunity if you can. Kathy's a great resource and has been involved in the field for many, many years at the national level. So it's great to talk to you again, Kathy, and look forward to having you here in Park City.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thanks for joining us, Kathy. We will take a quick break for a few underwriters.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Well, it's time to wrap up another show of This Green Earth. We, of course, want to thank our underwriters, including Republic Services,
Recycle Utah,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Mark Miller Subaru,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
Park City Mountain,
San Francisco Design.
And as always, you can email us with your thoughts, comments, and suggestions for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You're listening to KPCW 91.7 FM.